Hello and welcome to Against the Law, the myth-busting ancient history podcast that aims to separate fact from fiction in the ancient world. Today we will be continuing the season's theme of looking at ancient reception in popular culture, and now we're talking about notable documentaries, some of which might prove life-changing. Not to brag, but I've been the subject of a documentary myself, so I find myself in great company today as we're going to be discussing dusty old relics and historical has-beens with the podcast crew. As ever, I'm joined by Xenia, who's talking about ancient Rome, Meg, who's talking about the ancient Greeks, and Barney, who's talking about the ancient Near East. Now, I'm Flo, and I don't have an area of expertise, but I'm excited to learn about reception in documentaries with you, dear listener. P.S. If you're listening from the UK, you can actually check out Inside Our Artistic Minds on BBC iPlayer. I wasn't joking about the documentary bit. I am dusty, though. So now it's time for you guys to pitch me some documentaries for me to watch. And I'm very excited about that. I like a good documentary, and I can speak more about my documentary experience later. But everyone here has some connection to documentaries in some way or another. But Xenia, I'm going to start with you. Can you pitch me a documentary that you think that I should watch or is notable in some way?
Absolutely. So I'll start with something that was quite influential in my youth and which I actually had on DVD. Oh my gosh, remember those?
What's that?
What do you mean, do I remember those?
Literally ancient history.
Oh yeah. Oh my God, I'm so old.
Was it like a hard floppy disk?
Yeah, but round. And then... Wait, floppy disk isn't even
floppy
older.
Disk also, were they not also round?
They were genuinely... round.
Is it like a flat Betamax? Is it like a polyphonic record, Xenia?
Yeah, it's like a small shiny record when you put it in the telly.
Wow.
Is it like a clay tablet, but instead of being inscribed by a reed, it's inscribed by a laser?
Yes, it is.
Oh my God. The ultimate clay tablet.
They don't get harder when there's a fire, though. They just melt. So that's a manufacturing error.
But both can be used as frisbees with varying degrees of success.
So I had this documentary on DVD. It was called Michael Woods in the Footsteps of Alexander the Great. And yeah, that's what he does in the documentary. He kind of follows the path of conquest of Alexander the Great. Can't remember very much about it, but I think it was really nice to have such an epic scale of the documentary. And it's something that kind of everyone's a bit intrigued by, isn't it? It's kind of the scale of Alexander the Great's travels. At one point, I think he goes to Afghanistan and sees Alexandria on the Oxus as well, which is super exciting.
Do you recall, did he go to Iraq as well?
Don't remember. I'm pretty sure he went to Iran though, right? Persepolis. He definitely went to Persepolis.
Honestly, like the access that he had on that documentary. When did it come out? Like early 2000s?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's. I think I've seen a clip of him going to the battlefield where, roughly where Gaugamela should be, where Alexander defeated the Persians, which I think is in Iraq. And I think he was escorted by the US Army or something like that.
Oh,
and
it's my just goodness.
Absolutely insane for like about 30 seconds of television.
Wow. They have budgets in those days.
He's done loads, right? I feel like I also watched a Trojan War one from like the 80s with Michael Wood. Didn't he do like a Dark Ages one as well, like a really old school one?
He's had a good career, hasn't he?
Yeah.
So what did you like about it, Xenia?
I like the scale. I like the scale of travel. I think that's one thing that sort of got me quite excited about exploring further east, especially sort of steppe land and the Stans, you know, being able to go to Afghanistan and see that kind of very, very remote Alexandria. Well, it seems remote now, but again, then looking back and thinking, actually, this was a huge bustling city after Alexander the Great founded it, and how things change over time. That was really cool.
I've just Googled Michael Wood, and he looks like the sort of guy who'd be my favourite teacher. Well, nice fella. Okay, well, I don't know, but he could actually be awful. It sounds like he makes good documentaries at the very least. I do quite like the idea of him travelling to these places and in situ telling the story, which sounds really stupid because most documentaries do have that, but it sounds like he's also been to some dangerous zones, and I appreciate the endeavour to deliver documentaries from dangerous places, especially at that period of history. Oh, that sounds cool. Okay. Might have to check that out then. I shall reserve my judgment until the end of the episode.
I'll tell you about another one that had a huge effect on me, possibly life-changing. So that was my kind of soft open. this is the turning point. Dan Snow did a documentary about Hadrian.
Here we go. And that was the rest is history.
The rest is history. Genuinely, that was what got me interested in the Emperor Hadrian. And then I got like Nicholas Purcell's book about Hadrian, and then I got Marguerite Yourcenar, and then I got Anthony Burley. And, you know, I just really haven't stopped since then. That was what got me into Hadrian. And I had the privilege and the pleasure of working with Dan Snow genuinely about 10 years later when I was working in TV. And he said to me, I told him about the documentary. I said, you know, that was what got me into Hadrian. That was such a massive documentary for me. And he said, it was a massive documentary for him as well. Aww. In his words, that was his first sort of big boy documentary he was allowed to do.
Oh,
as in, like,
lovely.
Not with his dad, his first solo one. And it was really important to him.
And did he also fall in love with Hadrian?
No, he didn't. He's actually, his specialism is in Russian history, I believe.
So what you're telling me is that Dan Snow is a gateway drug to other historians?
Yes.
Okay, might have to watch that. Any parents listening, any teenagers listening, be careful with your Dan Snow consumption, because it could lead to careers in classics. Watch out.
Or a life, or a lifelong obsession with the Emperor Hadrian.
Yeah, potentially that as well. Oh, so that really is one thing that we know about you, is your love of Hadrian. So that really, that must have been sort of groundbreaking, captured your attention.
I owe it to Dan.
Wow. Okay, that's fantastic. I am quite keen to see this sort of life altering documentary that you've dropped on us. That sounds really good. Meg, how about you pitch me something?
I'll pitch you something, Flo. I'm actually gonna start my pitch with a brief confession. If you'll hear my sins, Flo.
Confess to me, child.
Forgive me, Flo. I don't really watch documentaries about ancient history or about anything else. I know it just, and it's, that is a sort of cardinal sin in our field, and also given Barney and Xenia's previous, like, current and previous work experience. So I hate to admit it, but I'm just not a doc girly, and I don't know why. I like them. Whenever I sit down and watch a documentary, I'm like, God, I should do this more often. But I think I've maybe watched two documentaries in the last 5 years, probably both of them in the first lockdown. So that's the sort of the caveat at the beginning of this pitch.
I feel like your caveat kind of rings true to me, though, because my dad is a bookseller. I've got a house full of books, and I've not read any for probably, I think I don't know how to read anymore, actually. And I wouldn't know how the pages worked. I can't scroll on them. So I'm going to forgive you for that.
Yeah, exactly. I think it might be for me personally that when I'm watching TV, I want it to be absolute, like, escapism garbage. And when I'm reading about the ancient world, and that was a sort of Freudian slip right there, when I'm consuming media about the ancient world, I want it to be books. And I don't know why. Maybe I should unpack that in some sort of therapy.
What if I told you, Meg, that TV documentaries can be escapist garbage?
Well, now I'm listening.
And I am a purveyor of fine documentaries in that category.
I'm so excited to hear Barney's pitches in that case. But I do have, like Xenia, I do have a documentary that sort of changed my life a little bit. And it was called Pompeii, Life and Death in a Roman Town. And it was a Mary Beard documentary. I think it was on the BBC in about 2010. Let me actually just check that. I think it was 2010.
I love Mary Beard.
Yeah, I mean, she's a great documentary host. Let's be honest with ourselves. She does know exactly what she's doing. Seasoned professional, but also so sort of warm and relatable in a way that I think, I'm not saying she invented it, but it was definitely a shift from other documentaries I'd seen, which again is probably because I didn't watch many documentaries. Anyway, it really did. It just got me into it. I think Pompeii, it was a bit of a passion of mine as a teenager. And I think it is for a lot of nerdy teenagers who sort of start getting into ancient worlds. So again, it's a bit of a gateway drug, isn't it? It's a bit like, oh, Pompeii, volcano. Oh, and then before you know it, you're reading about, you know, the beginnings of democracy. But it was just so impressive, and they did something which I think we talk about quite a lot on the podcast, and they made those people's lives feel very, very real, and their sort of bodily lives and their experiences, and not just the sort of intellectual or archaeological or like textual literary history, and that the sort of premise of it, you know, it's called Life and Death in a Roman town. It was sort of, yes, we all know about their deaths, that's the thing that they're now famous for, these Pompeians, is that the word, these people who lived in Pompeii, but their lives were also equally fascinating. So that's the sort of premise. And there was also the British Museum exhibition a couple of years later, Life and Death in Pompeii and Herculaneum. And I wrote on my UCAS personal statement to study classics at university, I wrote about both the documentary and British Museum exhibition. Like a true little nerd, I said I'd been engaging in some co-curricular activities.
Dweeb, nerd, bullies.
Embarrassing.
Gonna bully you. So Pompeii as a topic affected me quite heavily as a child as well. So, you know, the plaster casts of the bodies or what were the space that bodies inhabited once, as Vesuvius cooked them real good.
Good Lord,
this might be a therapy. He cooked them real good. Boiled their brains and their skulls, I think I once read. As a child, I used to just be frightened of quite a lot of things. Still am, actually. Big anxiety haver over here. And so when I used to go to bed at night, sometimes to entertain myself, I thought if a volcano hits the southwest of the UK, just in case, I better sleep in a funny shape to confuse future historians. And I used to think this every night for maybe a year. So I used to deliberately go to sleep in positions that would be confusing to future historians if I got cooked in my bed.
What kind of positions are we talking here?
Like, I don't know, making a V shape. So with my arms by my side and my legs like straight, like I was jumping off a diving board or something. Okay. Or
I like how the promise of dunking on future historians was was more important to you than having a good night's sleep.
Yeah, absolutely.
Commitment to the bit. Flo didn't sleep for 10 years.
Yeah, to be honest, I still occasionally think that now. Like, what would be a really good prank to play on someone who digs me up in the future? Anyway, I've derailed things slightly, but yes, the Pompeii was really important for me as a child, as well as I started to learn about the ancient world, because it was just so fascinating that it was like a Mary Celeste of this is an in situ, abandoned in time moment. That's a really powerful thing. Like, just like you said about hearing about the lives of real people and making that very colourful and tangible.
100%.
Barney, what have you brought to pitch to me today?
Hello. So I was thinking with the documentary that I've bought, like how much it represents reception of the ancient world. I feel like we haven't like defined how documentaries fit into, you know, our reception ideas for this series, because, you know, it's a bit more clear cut with something like The Prince of Egypt, which is an adaptation of a story from that time, but with sort of modern stylistic choices. Whereas documentaries are often quite aligned with, you know, the academic research that's going on. And so whilst the demand for documentaries is probably part of the reception, maybe sometimes if they're very closely aligned with the research itself, I guess arguably that's reception as well. I don't know. I defer to Meg on this, whether academic research is reception of the ancient world or not. I'm not sure it is.
It's a fantastic question. And I was also pondering it, because then reception of the ancient world is also a field of academic study. So if academic research is reception, then reception studies is reception.
Oh, wait, it's all reception?
It's all reception. It's all noise. Yeah.
Always has been.
Yeah.
Reception, okay. Inception. Inception, reception.
Anyway, what I was going to suggest was that there are lots of different types of documentaries. You know, people might have seen the more recent Alexander documentary on Netflix, which is a sort of a docudrama. So I'd say that's maybe more closely aligned with what we've been defining as reception in the sort of TV and film world. Whereas the sort of the pure, very old-fashioned documentary is maybe a bit more along the research edge. But anyway, the fact that a documentary like that, a slightly fusty, old-fashioned style one, does exist, gives me a chance to pitch, possibly for the first time in this little trilogy, something actually from the ancient Near East or about the ancient Near East. Big gasp. So actually at a similar time to when Meg was attending exhibitions and, you know, generally being lame for her personal statement, a documentary was released I think originally titled Finding Babylon's Hanging Garden, which sort of adapted the research of a British Assyriologist called Stephanie Daly, who I've mentioned a few times on the podcast before, because she has this theory about the Hanging Gardens of Babylon not being in Babylon at all, but actually being in Assyria, in Nineveh. And so Stephanie Daly has researched this and would have published, academic publications about this for most of her career. She then wrote a popular history book called The Mystery of the Hanging Garden of Babylon that was then adapted into this documentary. And I think it premiered on Channel 4 and then was sent off to America to do its round of slightly more scandalizing sounding titles. So on PBS, they called it Secrets of the Dead, The Lost Gardens of Babylon. And what this was just a pretty standard documentary with her as a sort of a lead contributor explaining her research to everybody. And she went out to Iraq, if I remember rightly, and just talked through the research that you can find in her book as well. And I think I was given that book as a gift, possibly after deciding that I wanted to study ancient Near Eastern studies at university, and then was overjoyed to find that, and don't tell Stephanie Daly this, that I didn't need to read the whole book because I could watch it as a documentary.
Oh, did you not want us to gasp at that point?
Big gasp. So I have since read the book, but since I got them both at the same time and 18-year-old me was strapped for free time, I watched the TV documentary and it was great. And that was, I think, the model on which my attention was focused when I started to get into TV documentary work, because I really liked that you know, this TV format could sort of present some pretty serious academic research that's quite obscure to most audiences in a very accessible way. I mean, it has the benefit of representing, you know, one of the seven wonders of the ancient world, which is familiar to a lot of people, but, you know, all the nuance about Assyria versus Babylonia and stuff, that's all very unfamiliar. And I think that's a great potential that documentaries have. Is to be able to engage people with just a little hook on something that maybe they didn't know very much about before. And that's why for the anti-pitch that I'll bring to you later, I find that TV documentaries can also sometimes be a little bit patronising of their audiences as well. But yes, this documentary that does exist, the old Channel 4 one, the Finding Babylon's Hanging Garden, is great. And I do recommend it if anyone can get hold of it. It did come out a decade ago, so it might be a bit hard to find now. But yeah, it was a very good piece of TV, I thought.
After a quick Google, I think if you were peg-legged with an eye patch, you might be able to find it quite easily.
One more question about reception and documentaries. If we decide to sort of bubble wrap academic research and its mediation, let's say, in its own little category, there's probably still a degree of reception that the documentary makers can apply over that bubble wrap, like the graphics that they make in the show, right? And how they choose to represent the ancient world visually, maybe moving with some sort of animations or something like that. Or, importantly, whether or not they choose to use the font Papyrus in the title.
Do you know what I watched for the first time the other day? Avatar. Not The Last Airbender, but Avatar, blue people have sex through their hair. That uses Papyrus font.
It should be illegal, I think. Barney, I also completely agree, though. I think that is really interesting. And I think I'm leaning towards it is all reception because it is all interpretation, which is ultimately just what reception is. That even a documentary, even if it is making academic research rather than like sort of aesthetic or like primarily creative interpretations, they are still there, right? Those aspects. So I think we can call it reception.
Yes. Yeah. And I think in this case, although Stephanie Daly would have been heavily involved in the documentary, ultimately the sign off on the script and the visuals would all have been, you know, the work of the creatives at the production company that made it. So, yeah,
sure. I think I'm with you. Agreement across the board.
I suppose in a way, documentaries can be a bit patronising and to a certain extent should be a bit patronising, so that in terms of audiences, anybody can start watching it and go, I don't know what they're talking about. Oh, they've explained it. Cool. So I quite like being patronised with a documentary. I like people not assuming that I will have a great knowledge of the history of the Assyrians, for example.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think my qualms with the patronising, what I call patronising, I think other people might describe it in a different way, is that you, Flo, seem to suggest that you have a natural curiosity for these things and that you would like to watch something about which you have, you know, very little knowledge and like to feel like you can understand it. The issue is when, for me at least, when you're not presented with anything outside of the familiar.
Oh, I hear you.
Yeah, so any Rome documentary will have to be about Julius Caesar or will have to be about gladiators, or anything about Egypt will have to be about Tutankhamun or Cleopatra. What the issue is to say that people won't engage with it because there's no name recognition. I think there are always creative ways to sort of hook people in and then tell a more obscure story. And it doesn't always have to be Alexander the Great over and over again.
Oh, I definitely agree with you then. I think it is patronising to assume that the general public wouldn't be interested outside the scope of a year six school history class. I think you're totally right there. And actually, some of the more niche topics and more unusual or lesser heard topics are more interesting for that reason, because they're not things that you've heard before or you're not familiar with. So yeah, definitely agree with you there. I'm not going to name it, but there's a documentary at the moment, I think it's on Netflix, that I've been watching, that it's so bizarre in its theories about ancient peoples. And it's patronising not to the viewer, well, partly to the viewer, but also to ancient peoples, insofar as it's like, oh, isn't it incredible that these people could use bricks? But yeah.
That's very annoying.
Yeah, they're made of earth.
Can you imagine being 2,000 years ago and being able to line up a wall? They've been doing that without spirit levels forever. And I find that really patronising as well. And it's just a bit cringe. So on the topic of documentaries that are a bit patronising or a bit poo, like I've just mentioned, not the one that Barney mentioned, have we got any anti-pitches? Pitches for documentaries that are interesting and notable, not because they're fantastic, but because they are something else.
I've got several.
I'm all ears.
There are quite a few docudramas on Netflix at the moment. They really seem to be having a bit of a moment. And one of them that I noticed was a docudrama about Boudicca, that famous story. But what confused me about that documentary was Boudicca and her husband and her daughters are all dressed in very Roman outfits. And like, not only is that not really correct, like, they're literally a British tribe. They're not Roman. That's the point. But also, I mean, they just look a bit cold, quite frankly. Like, those kinds of sort of floaty dresses are great if you're in nice, warm, sunny Italy. Not so great if you're in rainy Essex, where Boudicca was from. So that was a bit... bit off-putting for me, was that kind of costume choice and staging choice.
I'm quite enjoying the anti-pitch concept. Sonia, have you got any more anti-pitches for me?
I do have another one, also on Netflix. Yay, well done Netflix for your docudrama quality. This one had another famous name attached to it. So it was exec produced by Jada Pinkett Smith, and it was the Cleopatra series. All about how, and again, a docudrama, apparently it was all about how Cleopatra was black. What do we think of that, Barney?
Yeah, I mean, that's a pretty controversial opinion in the Egyptological world. And I'm not sure that there are many academics who give it much truck. That's not to say that there were not black rulers of ancient Egypt. There was a dynasty in the late period that came from Sudan, the Kushite dynasty, and these were, you know, the people that we would call black by today's language. But no, Cleopatra herself, I think there's possibly no Egyptian ruler that we could be more certain was not black.
I think what got me about especially the trailer to the documentary was there was a contributor on there who said, I don't care what they tell you at school, I don't care what they tell you in history books, Cleopatra was black. That made me quite worried, to be honest. You know, documentaries are supposed to be about helping people learn more about something that they might have an initial interest in, right? It's about triggering their interest, let's say. We've talked about hooks. So hooking them in with something that intrigues them, and then telling them more information and helping them go away with something that they didn't know, actually. and maybe telling a fuller story. So to have a documentary on the premise, based on the premise of ignoring every single piece of actual evidence, it makes me quite concerned, really.
Yes, and there was a sense, I think, when that trailer came out, and that was where everybody first got that soundbite, that, you know, it was generating a massive amount of discussion online on the merit of being controversial alone, which, you know, is a pretty clever marketing ploy, whether or not that was intentional or that was something that, you know, that the broadcasters just found they had fall into their laps. You know, that generated a huge amount of interest in the programme. I haven't seen it. I don't know if you watched it at all, Zenia.
I did not watch much of it. I struggled.
I saw the trailer. but yes, it's a shame to see something, you know, like ancient history, which is already so open to misinterpretation and misunderstanding, be sort of wielded and weaponized in that way, you know, to generate controversy and therefore to sell, you know, more subscriptions or get more views for this particular format. I think that's one of the tricky things with TV documentaries, and that's why it's so different from the world of academia, is that ultimately there's money involved and there's risk. There are risks that production companies don't want to take. There are bigger risks that broadcasters don't want to take. And, you know, ultimately you are selling a product. And so, you know, this is something, Zenia, that I've thought about a lot in my career, that, you know, we have to balance the desire for academic rigor also with popular appeal. And then, you know, the fact that this is commercial activity, basically, is designed to make money, not just to inform and entertain.
Also, there is a wealth of incredible Black historical figures that you could focus a documentary about instead of retconning Cleopatra.
Preach!
For sure.
Thank you. Yes. Poor Cleopatra gets co-opted to all of these different things, all these different things that people want to put on her. And like, the point is, no, just let her be Cleopatra. Let her be a historical figure. Let's not keep projecting ourselves onto this poor woman. But, you know, at the end of the day, Cleopatra was queen of Egypt, right? So, Barney, what did you've worked on a lot of Egypt documentaries. What did actual Egyptians think of the documentary?
Yeah, so when that trailer came out, I messaged some of my colleagues from Egypt, and I've just gone back to find the messages now. I got an incredible number of emojis essentially communicating just head in hands.
Wow.
Amazing.
This is a conversation that I've had with, you know, with modern Egyptians about their sort of historic identity, because, you know, modern Egypt is an Islamic country, but that's a development that's happened in the last millennium and a bit. And that doesn't mean that they can't trace their sort of slightly more like ethnic identity back even further. And a lot of Egyptian people do see themselves as distinctly related to the pharaohs and you know, the people of ancient Egypt pre-Greece and Rome and everything Mediterranean. And therefore, I think it creates a distinctly modern problem when Western documentary makers come along and say, no, those senses of identity are faulty. And actually, we know what's best. We know that, you know, Cleopatra was Black, or that, you know, the all the pharaohs were Black, or something like that. It's, yeah. And I feel like the Egyptian voice in this matter doesn't often get as much representation as what documentary makers in the US and the UK might get.
That was fascinating.
Ultimately, I don't see there being a problem with modern Egyptians having both an Islamic identity that might be closer to modern Arab populations and a Mediterranean identity and acknowledgement of where they are geographically in the world, and also a sort of historicized identity that sees them that much more in dialogue with the people of ancient Egypt thousands and thousands of years ago. And yeah, I think it can be quite patronizing when modern media productions try and challenge that in some way.
Agreed. Definitely agreed.
Yeah, I think, Barney, you're absolutely spot on there. You know, this is part of the cycle of reception, isn't it? That you kind of go through these constant conversations, because what I think, you know, the producers of that Netflix Cleopatra docudrama were trying to do is again, it's this co-option of power, isn't it? They see Cleopatra as a powerful figure and they want to co-opt her to their own kind of cultural story. But unfortunately, that ended up being at the expense of, you know, the people who are potentially her actual descendants, you know, the people who were are still part of the land that she governed extremely effectively. So when we are doing this wonderful series of reception, I think we've had so much fun doing our pitches. Maybe this is our call. As much fun as reception is, let's use it as an encouragement to go back to the source material, to like go back to what we really do know about the ancient world.
So true. Hear, hear.
Hear, hear. Yeah, I think Lenya, I know that earlier in the podcast I mentioned an anti-pitch of my own. I think you've probably summed up quite a lot of the things that I was going to anti-pitch, actually. So I won't talk about any docudramas particularly, but I will add my own little mini anti-pitch, which is, to be honest, it's quite a specific TV thing, but I think most listeners will have seen it in a TV documentary at some point. My anti-pitch is the idea of drama recon, so drama reconstruction or dramatic reconstruction in TV documentaries, which will be familiar to viewers of any documentary as the moment where the presenter or the contributor finishes what they're saying, the camera cuts, and we go to like a little bit of illustration, and it's a sort of an anonymous looking actor in a tunic carrying like a little candle down a corridor, and then they get stabbed, and there's like a splash of very fake looking blood on the wall. And you know, a bunch of coins hit the floor, falling out of, you know, fake ancient coins out of this purse. And I don't know what scene I'm imagining here. And then it cuts back to the presenter or the contributor. And these are those little bits of like visual flavor that documentary makers often have to use to kind of add visuals into a program if they believe that, you know, what they've shot or had time to shoot or can afford to shoot isn't quite like visual enough. And the reason why it's an anti-pitch for me is that it's often so cheaply and poorly done that it kind of ruins the overall experience. I mean, clearly in the example of these docudramas, often the drama is, you know, a huge part of the budget, and you know, they'll get historical consultants on board in the same way that you might in a movie, and great attention to detail is paid in costumes and weapons and everything like that. Unfortunately, in the relatively lower budget world of just like factual documentaries, they don't look quite as good. And I think it can cheapen the overall experience. I don't know if you have any thoughts on this, Lenya, but, you know, when it's like somebody's mate standing in as Julius Caesar.
Yeah, I have been in that cast. Yeah. Oh, we just need a slave girl. All right, fine. In I go.
Oh, no.
Tunic up.
That's awful.
Tunic up.
Yes. So in my opinion, I've worked on a fair few docudramas, and in my opinion, you either have to get, you have to go at least 50% drama to make the whole effect and the budget worth it. Because what often happens is producers try to upsell the documentary to the commissioners by saying, hey, we're going to add some drama as well, and it's going to look even cooler for you. But then
it's going to look like Game of Thrones. Mm,
yeah, but then they don't save enough budget for it. And yeah, you end up doing it down a dark corridor with the cheap shots or the reused shots, and you just play the same ones again and again and again, because you've, drama's much more expensive than documentary. So if you're going to make a drama, if you're only going to make a little bit, and you're gonna like it just ends up being a money sink, and you could have put that money, in my opinion, to use much better on getting more interesting GVs or doing a few more documentary sequences if all you're spending that money on is just 20% of your visuals. I've worked on others that are 80% drama, and that is much, much easier. You're basically doing a drama with some interviews plopped in every now and then to kind of back up the factual nature of what your drama is. So that's a much easier format to make work, I think. Spend all your money, or spend as much money as possible on the drama, and do it properly. Don't just put it in as an afterthought.
What, with the M25 in the background, and like it's obviously some quarry in Wales, and someone's got a wristwatch on. I also really like it when someone's got like a really nice fade haircut.
Yeah.
That's the problem, you know, in a genre of entertainment and media that is predicated on at least like an attempt at factual accuracy or historic, you know, representation of historic research. When you do cheap drama recon, you open yourselves up to so much inaccuracy just because, you know, just because of budgetary constraints, I think it's sometimes not worth it at all, really. So that's why it's my anti pitch.
I've got a pitch for a documentary if you'd like to hear it.
Oh yeah.
Ooh.
It's so off pieced but very on pieced that I'm going to try and find a way of linking it to ancient history. As I say, I suppose the only link is to the podcast Against the Law, which is a really good podcast if you ever get the chance to listen to it. Anyway, one of the people on the podcast, Flo, is autistic and took part in a documentary called Inside Our Autistic Minds for BBC Two. And it's hosted by Chris Packham, who's autistic. And there are other contributors as well who are all showing different elements of their autism. And I just thought, this is groundbreaking. And indeed, it has won a couple of awards. And Flo went to one of the award ceremonies and thought it was very lovely and saw Louis Theroux was sat in the same row as her. And she thought, crikey, if only I didn't have social anxiety, I'd go and say hi. I would really highly recommend it. I don't know if you guys have seen it at all, but I thought it was great.
I thought it was great too, Flo.
Yeah, really enjoyed it. That's the only one we're all unilaterally shouting out.
Yeah, absolutely. They did actually come and film a segment while I was doing the podcast at one point. I don't think it made it into the cut. One, I need to work out which episode it was, but one of our episodes has me very self-consciously making jokes as there's a camera outside the window and inside the house and a very quiet ninja-like camera operator zipping about getting footage. So yeah, I thought if we were talking about documentaries, I had to give it a mention, didn't I?
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I think it has come time to decide which our favourite pitches were from today. I think, Barney, I'm probably going to start with you, actually. Barney, can I hear your favourite pitch from today?
I think that I will go with Michael Wood, Xenia's Michael Wood documentaries. Not because I think that's a style that we necessarily need in 2024 to communicate with people about the ancient world, but because I miss the days of high-budget documentaries that could actually afford to send reasonably sized crews to lots of different locations around the world where you actually needed to go to cover the material that you need.
Yes.
So yeah, that's why it's with a little tear in my eye.
The golden age of funding. The
golden age.
You belong to a different era of documentaries, don't you, Barney?
You hipster.
Yeah. Yes.
Xenia, in that case, I'm going to come over to you. What pitch has made you think, I need to find that documentary and watch it?
Well, I think I'd like to revisit Meg's suggestion of Mary Beard's Life and Death in a Roman Town, Pompeii. Because I haven't watched anything about Pompeii in a while. And the first ever proper job I had in TV was on one of Mary Beard's documentaries. And I really should do her the courtesy of watching something else that she made.
A sort of a shame watch. I should have watched this ages ago. Watch.
Yeah.
Love that. Powerful, powerful form of entertainment, that. In which case, Meg, I'm going to hop over to you now. Which pitch do you think is tickling your fancy today?
Well, I think I'm going to complete the circle and say I was very intrigued by Stephanie Daly's research on the Hanging Gardens of Babylon and where they are. So I think I might seek that out.
Slightly irritated because you've each in sequence picked the pitches that I wanted to go for. So I'm just going to cheat and say that's me too. Sames, babe. Me three. Me four, in fact, because there's four of us. I was actually quite intrigued by Xenia's life-altering Dan Snow documentary about Hadrian. So I think that I might go for that one. If I can find it somewhere, I think I shall be giving that a watch sometime soon. I've really enjoyed today. Quite like a documentary, unlike Meg. But you can read the books and I'll watch the documentaries, Meg. How about that?
Perfect.
Brilliant. So this was Against the Law, and you can catch us next time for another scintillating episode. If you've enjoyed today's episode, you can always choose to support us on Patreon.
We've got all sorts of tiers for every budget, starting from just £3 a month. Benefits include getting each episode a day early, stickers, and your name in cuneiform.
You can find us on Twitter @AgainstLaw, and you can also find us on TikTok @AgainstTheLawPodcast.
We're also always happy to hear suggestions, questions about the podcast and other requests. If you want to email us, our email is againstthelawpodcast@gmail.com.